the parent's perspective. Natasha, for the last time, we have to go. Natasha's mom called to her four-year-old from the door of the daycare center. I'm sorry, Mrs. Burns. The daycare teacher walked over to follow her gaze to Natasha in the play yard. Natasha sometimes gets so involved in her play that it's hard for her to make these kinds of transitions. Well, certainly after a whole day of doing whatever she's been doing, she should be ready to come home. What she's been doing hasn't been the same thing all day, the teacher explained. She's especially fond of the dress-up corner, but she likes the big blocks and, as you can see, the sandbox. It's not like she doesn't have toys at home, Mrs. Burns sniffed. I just can't see why she's so attached to all this stuff. I mean, it's only play. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about the importance of play in a child's development? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today is a well-known expert in the developmental needs of young children. Dr. David Elkind is a professor of child development at Tufts University. His research in the areas of perceptual, cognitive, and social development of young children led to his books, among which are The Hurried Child, All Grown Up and No Place to Go, and the newest, The Power of Play, How Spontaneous Imaginative Activities Lead to Happier, Healthier Children. He's a much-loved author and psychologist, past president of the National Association for the Education of Young Children, and a frequent TV guest on such programs as The Today Show, 2020, Oprah, and the Lifetime series in which he co-hosted Kids These Days. He's the father of three sons and grandfather of three girls. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Elkind.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why is children's play so important?
Well, I think we have the wrong idea about play, as your opening example suggested, that play is somehow a luxury and children are sort of wasting time when they play. And the point I try to make in the book is that play is a basic human drive, and just as work is and love is, and that it takes different forms, different age levels, but it's something that children have to do, and they will do it. And we can't prevent them from playing, but we can limit the times and the opportunities they have to play. And that's what I'm worried about, because play is the way in which children learn, creating their own learning experiences. Traditional learning, the experience comes from without, but in play, children create their own learning experiences. The infant who drops a rattle out of the crib, for example, is discovering gravity. A child who, you know, begins to put pebbles in a circle and then in a square and then in a diamond discovers that no matter what shape you put in, they're still the same. That's through his or her own experience, and there are so many experiences with children playing a board game, for example. They see the facial expressions of the other children. They hear their voices. They see the body language. They're learning a lot of interpersonal skills. They're creating that learning experience for the other person as well. And they don't get that in a computer game. What troubles me is that children have lost 10 to 12 hours of free, unsponsored play in the last few decades, a week, so that they're losing those experiences, and those experiences are learning experiences, and so they're not learning certain things that they need to learn. And many of those, particularly in early childhood, many of those self-created learning experiences provide the basis for later learning, as I try to show in the book, later academic learning, that children, by learning about sameness and difference and so on, they begin to find the fundamentals of really the unit concept, which is basic to math, basic to reading, basic to science. So again, it's not a luxury at all. It's really very fundamental and a basic need of children. And when we unduly limit the opportunities children have to play, then we're also depriving them of important learning experiences.
When you refer to play, it's clear you're referring to non-directed opportunities, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Children's spontaneous, when it comes from them, a lot of the things that we call play are really sort of what I call watch me games and toys. Children are watching it wind up or a battery operator, and the child watches it bounces or make noise or do all that stuff. But there's no involvement of the child. And play always involves the child, involving his or her initiative, his or her creativity, his or her imagination. And if the activity doesn't involve that, it's not really play.
I had an interesting conversation with my son, who has a 2.5-year-old daughter, and she has little teeny pots and pans that she loves to play with. And I said, would you like me to get her a little kitchen? I saw a little one advertised, not a big expensive, you know, fancy thing. And so she could have a little oven and a little burner and a little sink you could put real water in and stuff. And he said, Mom, she pretends anything is a stove. And I'm not sure I want to rob her of that creativity.
Good for him. Good for him.
So we didn't buy the kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things that's happened in our homes, too, is we do less cooking and so on. Before, kids would take a rolling pin or they'd take a pie pan or a cupcake tin or something and make all kinds of things, and Kleenex boxes. And now, because we're so automated and so we don't have those things in our kitchen often, there's fewer toys for children to play. They're just these spontaneous things. And it amused me at the holiday time. I saw the kids unwrapping presents, and they were having more fun with the boxes the toys came in than with the toys themselves. And that just shows what children love to create. And the toys that have had lasting value, the ones that continue to intrigue children over the decades, are things like blocks and Lego and games like cards and Monopoly or those sorts of things, which challenge children's imagination. That's why they last. And the things that they have the short life are the ones that are just the watch me kind of toys.
How can we provide a positive play environment for our kids? Obviously, one thing is the kinds of toys.
Well, it depends clearly on the age of the child. I mean, preschool children, again, it's very important to allow them time and the opportunity to play, and play at their own pace and their own way. I guess one of the things that troubles me as often is that adults, we get bored with young children because they seem to play with the same thing again and again and again, or they want to hear the same story over and over again, and that's boring to us. But because children create their own learning experiences, each time they do something again and again, there's something new in there. We don't see it, but they see it, and so it's exciting and interesting to them, but not to us. And so we have to be careful not to intrude on that, and to recognize that even young children will spend a considerable amount of time at a particular activity if they're really engrossed with it. And that teaches them concentration and helps their imagination. So I think with young children particularly, we have to push back and away from telling them what they should be learning, what they should be playing with, and watch them. And I think that's very important. And school-age children, again, I think it's important for us to leave time for them to have some time to engage in spontaneous play, and the kinds of things that we give them, for example, that a kind of toys at all age levels that create a magic. Craft toys particularly are good for kids and school-age children, but also allowing them time to make and break their own rules and play games. I know environments are not as safe as they once were. They're probably more safe than we like to believe because of the mass media and so on, but children can still be taken to a play area, play their own games, and have an adult who's there sort of in the background making sure that everything's okay. And we don't take opportunities like that to allow children to play their own games and make up their own and break their own rules. That's so important. Adolescents, again, they find their own ways to play. I think they tend to be more creative, and writing poetry or putting on plays and that sort of thing is one's ways that adolescents can be creative. So I think at each level we have to sort of provide for the kinds of needs that children have. And I try to talk about that a little bit in the book.
It's interesting. One of the things that we always think about is that the actual environment is really significant, the physical environment. If we're not too invested in our homes looking gorgeous, if it's all right to take the sofa cushions off or bring a card table in and drape an Afghan over the top of it and have a fort. We had many forts when the kids were little.
Remember when you were looking for the blender and it was in the fort?
In the fort. Right.
Yeah, fort play is an important part of play, and my own kids did the same sort of thing, and they used the cushions and the couch and so on to make forts. And it's this need to sort of be enclosed and safe and so on, which is a healthy need, and again, is very creative and imaginative. All over the world, actually, fort building is a very common kind of thing that children do, and again, reflects the fact that play is a basic drive of children. It's not something that just tacked on and so on. It's something that, it's a need that children have because it's a way that they learn, and you can't take that away from them.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on the importance of children's play.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. David Elkind, author of The Power of Play, about children's play.
Given the opportunity to watch our children play, can we as parents spot their developmental progress, or should we be looking for anything when they're actively playing?
I think children will use different kinds of play at different age levels, and you can certainly tell something about a child's development by watching the kind of play that he or she engages in. So preschoolers, for example, like building blocks. If they are not really engaged in more complicated games in which they have personalities and so on, that tends to appear a little later. But if you have to really be pretty versed in developmental psychology to sort of use it in that way. But I think the major clue and the major important thing is the child being totally involved and totally engrossed. That's the clue, no matter what the activity is. And children vary tremendously. Some children are sports, and they just, you can't keep them away from sports. You can't keep them away from the playing field or from a skateboard or what have you. And other kids are readers, and they like to read. But those are both fine. Kids are different, and we have to accept that difference. The common ingredient is it comes from them and not from us. And that's really the critical thing. Rather than us telling them, you should be playing this game, or you should be reading this book, or you should... That's a death of play and death of creativity and imagination. If we support children, they know pretty much where they want to go. I always say the good teacher, the good parent watches the child. In business, the rule is keep your eye on the business. In sports, keep your eye on the ball. In child-rearing, it's keep your eye on the child.
It's interesting. We've talked about concentration spans and so forth. I think it's fascinating with babies, when you think of children from newborn to maybe 1 year of age, that usually... if you really watch them, you can see that they could concentrate for a long period of time on something.
Right.
Can you tell us about enriching or assisting any kind of baby's playtime?
What do you want to make available, I think is what's
right.
Amazing.
I can start by what you don't want to make available, if I may, because it's a pet peeve of mine are these new sort of so-called lapware for infants from 6 months to 2 years. And it's a computer program. The parent puts the baby on the lap. It's the fastest growing software, and the baby pushes a kind of mushroom-like mouse. And there are programs like Colors, which supposedly teach the child colors. Well, infants know their colors at 4 months, and they already have a color preference, so you're not teaching them anything. But I think the real problem I have with that is, among other things, is that you're asking the child to make responses, right and wrong responses. The baby doesn't know what he or she's doing, and the parents can't sometimes control. The baby makes a wrong response, they're going to respond. And babies are very responsive to our emotions, and so they know this parent is unhappy with me, but I don't know why, what I did, what I didn't do. That's very confusing and frustrating to an infant, and you don't need that kind of relationship with an infant. An infant needs to feel that this is a safe world, and I'm protected and supported, and so on. They don't need a world which is sometimes frustrating, and I think parents don't appreciate that. Computers have no place in the crib. That's the first thing. There are plenty of time for children to learn about computers later on. People say, well, you know, computers are part of our world. Yes, that's true, but microwaves are part of our world, too. We don't let infants use them, so there's plenty of time for them to learn about microwaves. But there are, I think, good toys like rattles, like furry toys, like a good play gym or crib. Mobiles, yeah. All of those are great for kids because they give them the colors, they can reach and they can do things. I'm not so, sanguine about a lot of these chip-embedded toys for the little ones. It's just too much, and they don't know where it's coming from. I mean, I know my granddaughter had one of these things. You push a button and the cow goes moo. Well, in the real world, you don't push a button to make a cow go moo. You know? I'm not sure that that's teaching her the right kind of thing. So I think that the less automated toys, I think, better. I know there's so many automated ones for young ones, but because they need to know about the real world, and I keep saying, children are not born knowing sweet and sour. They're not knowing rough and smooth. They're not born knowing all of those things. They're up and down, square and round. They have to see them. They have to touch them. They have to taste them. And those are real experiences that you can't substitute. And children have to have those before they have the virtual experiences in the two-dimensional screen kinds of things. So certainly there's a place for that later on, but in the first few years of life, the real world things are so important for children to have. And if you give them those, they'll concentrate on them for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. You know,
it sounds like a lot of the learning of infants, maybe all of it, is kinesthetically based. It's tactile. There's some wiring where without the ability to touch whatever it is, it doesn't matter that an apple is pretty on a screen if they can't hold it and feel it and
right. That's what Montessori said, was this is a sensory period. This is the period when children learn through their senses. And I think when we try to push a lot of stuff which is not sensory, I think they lose something out of there, and that's a basic kind of learning that all later learning is based upon, you know? And I think if they don't have that, they don't have that solid foundation. A little about Eric Erickson talked about children developing a sense of trust in infancy, and that foundation for all later learning, and that kind of sensory experience helps children learn that sense of trust, which provides them a basis for all later learning. And if children don't have that good sense of trust, it makes later learning more difficult.
In The Power of Play, you identified for us four different kinds of play: mastery, innovative, kinship, and therapeutic. Would you clarify?
Sure. Mm-hmm. And those are my, I mean, there are many people, there are many different categories of play. Sure. And it was just convenient from the kind of points that I was trying. And mastery play is really whenever we learn a new skill or a new, we have to repeat it over and over again until we master it. And so that's repetition, whether it's a child who's babbling or trying to repeat. I know my son was having trouble articulating L's, and he had to practice over and over and over again saying that. So in any activity, whether it's a sport or whether it's learning to read and so on, you have to practice again and again, and part of that is an attempt at mastery. So a mastery of play is involved in whenever we're beginning to learn something new, we often have to repeat it again and again as we develop that skill. But again, because we're in the very process, we're creating new experiences from which we're learning, and then we redo it. So it's a, still creating a learning experience, but it's a repetitive plus something new. And then the innovative play is an expression of mastery. Once we have mastered a skill, we tend to play with it. That's when we start to innovate. So children who are, for example, learning to go up and down a slide, they'll go up the slide, down the slide, up the slide, down the slide. As soon as they master it, they start climbing up or going down backwards or on their back and then fooling around. And we do the same as adults. If we're learning to ski, we may want to really feel very confident, and then we start fooling around. That's when we break our leg. You
know? Right.
So I think innovative shows the creativity, how creativity comes out. I gave the example of my son who couldn't articulate the L's. Well, once he managed it, and I came home one day, and he was sitting at the kitchen table singing a song to himself, and he was saying, yellow, yellow, yellow. It's so easy to say yellow. Where before he kept saying yayo. But now he mastered it, and now he'd made a song to celebrate his accomplishment. So that's innovative play, whenever we master something. And that's true in the sciences as well. I mean, it's only when someone gets to the frontiers of a science or a discipline that they can be creative. Even it's true for painters. He looks like he was just throwing paint at the wall, but he was trained as a classical painter. You have to know the basics before you go on to innovate, and that's true in any domain. Therapeutic play is that the children use play a lot of times to deal with anxieties. Peekaboo is a good example of therapeutic play. Children at the end of the first year begin to develop separation anxiety. They have a notion of the permanent object, an object that continues to exist when it's no longer present to the senses, and that's true for the parents. So then when a parent disappears, they begin to get anxious, fearful. And peekaboo is a way, by repeating this kind of thing of something hiding back again, they work that kind of anxiety through by going over again. It will reappear. It will reappear. I know it'll reappear. And so playing that game helps to reassure them that the parent will reappear. And so on. So it's a good example of a therapeutic play. Another is imaginary companions. Imaginary companions often deal with the child's issues about making mistakes and so on. They don't like to be wrong, and so sometimes they will have an imaginary companion. I didn't break that. Henry broke that. You know, Henry's always breaking things. You know? Of course, it goes on, and as older children, too, begin to use therapeutic play sometimes. I think you see kids in the playground or, for example, at the end of the school year, school's out, we can shout, or new more teachers, no more books, no more teachers, dirty looks and all that stuff. It's kind of play dealing with, you know, I'm done with that for a while kind of stuff. Yeah. So we play whenever we, you know, as a way to express anxiety, stresses and so on. And certainly with more disturbed children, it has, it show deeper significance. But there's a healthy kind of therapeutic play that all of us engage in.
You know, you talked a little bit before about how we've lost so much in terms of time and in terms of equipment for play that children have nowadays. How can we, as parents, help get that time back?
Well, in some ways, we can't. The world has changed. We now live in a screen culture, which is very different. We're not going to get away from screens or anything. So screens are part of our world, and we can't get away from them. And then certainly with television, cell phones, all those things, they're here and they're part of our world. But it is important for children to see the real world as well. So I think whatever time we can make for children to either be outside or engage in games and play that are not sort of screenplay, the kind of things that I talked about, whether it's Scrabble or Monopoly or just playing cards and so on. Those kinds of activities are very helpful. I think it's important for families today, because we are so busy, to set aside at least one time a week when the family can do something together, whether it's play a game, watch a television show, and talk about it afterwards or have a meal together. But it's family time, which is very important. But, and again, I know where we live. I often see cars lined up at the bus station. Now, we live in a very comfortable development on Cape Cod, which is very safe, that kids don't have to walk very far to get to the bus bus stop. But even adolescent parents drive there. And I see no reason why those kids couldn't walk. I always walk to school. It's a healthy environment. You can hear the birds. You can watch the plants. You can see all kinds of things. It's a good learning experience. And so I think there are little things that we can do. We don't have to always drive everywhere. We walk places. That can be a very important learning experience, as well as providing good exercise. So there, you know, I think parents get overwhelmed. I can't, there's so much, I can't do everything. And we can't do everything, but we can do one little thing. And if we take one little thing that we can do, whether it's walking to the bus stop or taking time each week to spend time with the family, the whole thing is too overwhelming. But setting aside one thing to do, whether it's playing a game in the morning or choosing a riddle in the morning before kids go to school and have them think about it during the day and so on, something to sort of get us out of ourselves, something to be playful. And again, I think whenever we can, go to the outdoors where the children do appreciate nature. Nature is part of our world, and children need to develop a healthy appreciation for it, and children do when they get a chance.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on the importance of children's play.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. David Elkind, author of The Power of Play, about the importance of play for children. For middle schoolers, would you say there's a difference between just fooling around and play that might have some more value to it?
Can I do a tangential for a moment? The initial concept of the middle school was to address the needs of early adolescent young people. And it was designed to have team teaching, a lot of time for children input and play and so on. What happened was that many school systems went to a middle school in the sense of starting at sixth grade, but went back to the traditional junior high, which is just a miniature high school. And that's very unfortunate, I think. So that I think the middle school, if it's really done well, it can be very age appropriate. But I think, unfortunately, it's often now turned into a kind of little junior high. And that's one of the real problems with the middle school. The problem is that young adolescents, as I say in the book, I talk about the play, love, and work as being the basic trilogy, that the play is in love and work when they're all can't together, they're most effective. Each one takes a different time, and play is critical in early childhood, work and childhood proper, and love in early adolescence. And one of the things that happens in early adolescence is love. Kids are very preoccupied. So I think in seventh grade, for example, they're only passing notes anyway, so not much work gets done. We call this seventh grade slump. I just wish we could take the whole year off and have them build a boat or put on a play or something like that, and that would speak to their needs to socialize, needs to deal with a lot of issues. And I think they come back to school refreshed. We don't build into our educational system what we know about child development and human development. We were just little vessels, and we filled them up so much each grade level. And kids aren't that way. They're human beings.
It's interesting. I think someone once told us that the public school system in this country was really modeled after the factory
culture from Europe, the school bells, industrial revolution. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, school bells and the so-called Carnegie unit. Well, the Carnegie unit that we use to measure is simply he developed it because he wanted a way to assess wages. Then you could set an hourly wage and so on. So that had nothing to do with education. It had to do with an hourly wage. And unfortunately, it was assimilated by the educational system. We're still trying to break that. One of the things we know now is that the adolescent sleep cycle is very different than the adult sleep cycle, that adolescents stay up later and they sleep later in the morning. And that's not because they're bad kids or anything else. It's just because our biology is such, we know they change a lot of ways in that sleep cycle. So that in places like Minneapolis, where some schools start high school at 9 o'clock in the morning, kids do so much better than they do when they start at 7. But, of course, our schools aren't run by what we know about kids. They're run by bus schedules.
That's a big part of it, isn't it?
What can we learn about our children's mental and emotional health by watching them play?
Well, I think play is a good example of emotional health, because when children play, they're able to get out of themselves and to take perspective and so on. And so that's why play is so important. And children who don't play, who are so deadly serious and so on, take themselves too seriously and the world too seriously. And I think we all need to take perspective and to see the world from other ways. And that's why I think play is so important. One of the reasons why it's important is that it helps us get out of ourselves. I think one of the dangers we have as parents, we're so tempted always when children do something wrong to make character attributions. Oh, you're so clumsy, or you're always forgetting, or you're always doing this. And so sometimes when we use humor, he knows I'm angry, but I'm not attacking his character or anything, and then we can get down to the basics of what needs to be done. So I think sometimes using humor can be very helpful in disciplining, because it gets us out of that trap of trying to attribute bad motives or bad character to kids. And an incident a child engages in, it's a one-time thing, but how we handle that will have lifelong consequences in terms of how that child thinks about himself or herself, how he or she learns to deal with feelings and emotions, and how they themselves parent, because kids parent the way they've been parented. How we parent really has a long-term significance, and using humor, I think, is a very helpful way of making sure that we don't attack the child and we give them a good example of how to deal with bad feelings.
One thing I think we do need to say, because we're both sitting here thinking the same thing, and that is I made so many mistakes and so forth. I think, isn't it important for parents to give themselves a little slack as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I still wake up shivering sometimes about some of the mistakes I made with my kids. You do it. We're human beings. We all make mistakes. And it's very important to say, sorry about that. It was not well thought, and it was not the right thing to say. And so I think that we all make mistakes, but I think it's very important if we recognize that to try to, you can't take it away, but you can appreciate that you made a mistake, that you were wrong, that you're sorry about that. And I think that helps. But we're human. We do make mistakes, and I've made my share, more than my share, I'm afraid.
I think we need to forgive ourselves, and that's something that takes a while to learn when you're first parenting. Years ago, a nursery school teacher told my husband and me, your son needs to know that you make mistakes, that you do things wrong, that you have accidents, because if he doesn't learn that, he's going to continue on this path of thinking he has to live a perfect life. He won't try something new if he can't do it perfectly. That was a whole lesson for us, because it just never occurred to me to say to him, oh my gosh, look what happened, I broke the plate. You know, I'm just clean it up. And
we are so fortunate, Dr. David Elkind, that you have been able to be with us today to share your experience about the importance of play. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of one of Dr. David Elkind's books, The Power of Play or The Hurried Child. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 318 and tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Joseph and Anna Smith Foundation. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.